Hey, everybody. Good day. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Excited, as always, to have my two partners in crime. Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge for the OIG's Office of Investigations in Los Angeles, and now a director on our SIU investigative team. And, of course, Matt Kachansky, retired special agent in charge at the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC director. And my counterpart as the payment integrity senior director, and also sometimes is Christopher Walken's body double. Most recently, we had
I was a stand-in in Balls of Fury. We
had you walk down the Hollywood Walk of Fame last week just to see if anybody would just point and look. and nobody did, so maybe not that close to Christopher Walken.
Strictly
so.
For Tim Curry.
Maybe exactly that. So we want to talk about, we're going to meld a little SIU operational things with a press release that came out the other day. Interesting press release that came out of Florida, involving civil case, involving five ophthalmology practices that had entered into civil settlement agreements for medically unnecessary transcranial Dopplers, TCD tests. We've talked about this before. Matt Wade and I have talked about this at least one or two other times. But what makes this one interesting is this is a follow-up. So there's $6 million, five different practices, Medicare, Medicaid, lowest dollar amounts, about $300,000 for Medicaid, highest dollar amounts, a couple of million for Medicare. And it follows on to two other practices that had signed similar settlement agreements. So the number is up to seven. The five alone are for the $6 million, but it certainly does bring into play, you know, in the press release, one of the things they did talk about is some level of cooperation that's going on when you've got seven practices that are all entering into civil settlement agreements for the same thing. It of course leads one, and we don't know this to be true or not true, but it certainly leads one from an investigative perspective to think that the company might be cooperating on this. Because that would be where the tip of the spear is on this. And we do know that in a lot of instances, DOJ is seeking to have corporate accountability. And part of having a good corporate compliance program is to cooperate with government investigations on these things. So it is a little interesting because in other instances, the providers enter into the agreement or whatever they do, and they do not otherwise cooperate. And obviously, one of the things that always begs the question is, why was this handled as a civil case? Why was this not criminal? We will never know the backstory about that. When you read the press release, you could see that there were transcranial Doppler tests being done for patients who did not have a medical necessity for it, and that there were false diagnoses. And whenever you hear the word false diagnosis, that obviously rings the bell that there may be something, right? Fraud and false go together. We'll never know the story about that. But Wade, not that we want to sound like a broken record, but I know, you know, a little bit ago, we talked about the redheaded stepchild in data, and that is the diagnosis code. And oftentimes, we are so hyper-focused on CPT, HCPCS codes, and modifiers that we oftentimes forget about the diagnosis code that goes, because when a claim is paid, the data matches. The CMS claims rule says that as long as the claim is free of errors or omissions or falsities, it is going to be paid. And for the most part, because human eyes don't look at these things, these claims get paid. It doesn't mean that the claim isn't false. It just means that it's passed the algorithm muster. But, you know, in these instances, what we see from the press release is there were false diagnoses. And the thing that kind of stood out to the three of us was the fact that people did not have this diagnosis prior to having the test. And one would suspect that you would have that diagnosis, and then you'd have the test as a follow-on. And, you know, we see this, and I know I've talked about this on a case that I worked at when I was at the OIG. I had an internal medicine provider who was performing a HCPCS code G0166, external counterpulsation or enhanced external counterpulsation. And that is a cardiac related service for patients who are diagnosed at having stage two or three unstable angina, where they're not a candidate for surgery. And so they get this thing done, 35 sessions, 1 hour a day, or 2 1-hour sessions a day. And miraculously, on the case that I worked on, nobody had the diagnosis of unstable stage 3 angina until the very first visit. And so that obviously raised a red flag. But Wade, this is one of those things where the data should show you something when people never had the diagnosis until the day they got that service. And theoretically, there was no history of them having that diagnosis beforehand. And then lo and behold, everybody walking in the door is getting transcranial Doppler tests. And it appears in this instance, these people had very serious medical conditions, likely CVA, cerebrovascular accident or stroke, that led them to this. But this is one of those where we can't ignore ICD-10s, soon to be ICD-11s, and that data needs to be part of that conversation. That part of the data needs part of that conversation.
Right. And like you stated, that they didn't have the what should be a qualifying diagnosis ahead of time, before they had this testing done. So there's a problem there where that should probably be like a requirement in order to order the test. They should have some independently an independent diagnosis prior to taking the test, because post-test they're getting diagnosed with things like strokes, TIAs, various blood vessel narrowing or blockages, aneurysms, that type of thing, intracranial pressure, circulation problems, all these different things that if they didn't have these issues before, now it's likely going to be they're going to be diagnosed with one of these conditions, and it's likely going to be probably permanently in their medical record, or it's going to follow them depending on the different, a lot of times stuff don't transfer if it's a different provider, but it's part of your medical record now, and that probably will affect future plans of care, future, prescriptions. If all of a sudden you appear to be someone who had a stroke, that should affect your future care, and future physicians that you are seen by will assume that these diagnoses, if it's in the medical record, are truthful on, on face value. They're not going to second guess and go back and, investigate in reverse to make sure that there was a diagnosis before this TCD test was taken. So it's they obviously do it just for the money, but it really follows with the member or the patient into the future, and it could affect, future plans of care and prescriptions, and
Yeah, no,
it's a
that's a good
serious.
point. And what about if the person goes from traditional Medicare to a Medicare Advantage plan and somebody is culling through their prior medical records or their prior billing history? This is going to be considered a an aggravating condition or something that's going to maybe change their HCC, their risk score, right? The other thing too is that what this also does for people that may be staying in traditional Medicares, you've now set them on a path where if you've done this TCD previously, are you as a provider, are you now setting yourself up for a regular cadence of doing a test that didn't have medical necessity? Because if you've done this test and the results are negative, the question becomes, is this something where you're putting this patient into a monitoring category, right? Where you're going to continue to try to do something where there may be they're borderline or you've fabricated a test result or something to justify something. So there the collateral consequences are pretty substantial. It always does make me wonder when you see a case like this and you see that it was resolved as a civil matter, what was the issue that precipitated it? Now, I think to an extent, if these practices were relying upon the company that produces the machine that ultimately gives them billing guidance and all of that, is the argument the criminal, I'm an idiot defense, right? Because the I'm an idiot defense can actually be a defense in the criminal context, but not in the civil context. And that, that may be a piece of the puzzle. But Matt, it then begs the other half of the question, which is, so we've got seven of these practices in one geographic area. My guess, and I think our collective guess, is that they're probably all originating from the same manufacturer. I don't know for sure, but there's a possibility that it's there. But at least if it's not the same manufacturer, what we do know is that there's a lot of press releases about this. This is a known area of FWA, and so are practices just identifying opportunities to make money and things of that sort. So, again, it's one of those things where when you look at these press releases and you see that there are now seven that were all part of this same, they wouldn't have brought these all in and say these are all being resolved together. there's two others, there's cooperation, that there's some connection between the seven. But this kind of does get you back to why reviewing press releases are important, coupled with, is this to a point where from a payer perspective, you should be running your data to find out where are TCDs in your spend, and where are TCDs in your spend for ophthalmologists versus neurologists versus wherever. And then it kind of gets you to the last piece is this something that then requires, from an SIU payment integrity perspective, a special project? And do you assign one person to just kind of get in there and do like a targeted SIU enforcement?
Yeah. Let me do a quick evolution of this scheme. It really started with a IDTF firm out of Texas. We've seen it, when I was with the UPIC, we saw it spread across the country, area by area, starting in the Midwest. We saw dozens in New York and New Jersey, in the territory of the Northeast UPIC. Now it looks like it's going south. And all of it seems to go back to these IDTFs that were, you know, headquartered in Texas, but then opened up branch offices everywhere. And the scheme started out as, hey, buy this equipment, and here are the codes you can, you know, you can bill under. It was four codes, and then it reduced to three codes. But that quickly got caught because it was out of the ordinary for an optometrist to bill for these tests. And what they were doing is they were making these tests part of their annual eye exams. And nobody, we talked to the members and the beneficiaries, they never got the results. They just thought it was part of the eye exam. And so we started catching those very quickly. And then it matured to, oh, we'll do the tests. The IDTFs will do the tests. And we'll bill for those, but we'll do it in your office and we'll pay you rent for the space. And the rent was, of course, kickbacks for the number of patients. So harder to catch in the data, but you just have to, you know, try to find Benny histories of these optometrists and see if they have recent TCD tests. And again, go back to the diagnoses. What they were looking at was, like, if anybody had high blood pressure, they would do it. And they would just bump up the diagnosis to stroke risk because of high blood pressure. So we got dozens of them. Now it looks like it's moving, or had moved to South Florida, which is, so it is in the interest of any plan to look to see if these TCD tests are being billed in more amounts than normal, and see if they can relate it back to referring physicians, if it's an IDTF or another testing facility that's doing them, if the referring physician is an optometrist or something like that. And for some reason, they chose optometry as their specialty of note to try to market this stuff. And you can do your project that way. What we tended to do was, you know, we at the UPIC, we had the resources. So we full court pressed this. We went after all of them over a certain amount. We worked in collaboration with the other UPICs. We gave them the data we were receiving to see if they were getting similar things. We had a national project on this. But for an individual plan, you might not have those resources. So again, look at your data, see if there's any spikes in the TCDs, see if there's any relationship to an optometrist that's ordering them. And then maybe you just have to draw the line and say, we're going to fully investigate these four, because right, they're the highest billing, they're having the highest impact. Maybe the other ones, you send a letter to, a warning letter, saying, hey, we know what you're doing, you're out of the norm, stop it, or we're going to look at you and see if there's any behavior change because of it.
Right. Let me ask you. So Matt brings up a good point about kind of this warning letter premise, right? And the warning letter, right, and you've seen them, because I know on some of the other contracts you've used them. And the premise of the warning letter is kind of saying, hey, provider, we've identified that you're an outlier for this reason, FAFO. And right. I'm joking when I say it, but it's basically like, hey, we've identified this as a problem. In other work that you've done on some of our other teams, did you find that those letters, did they seem to have any level of persuasiveness? Did you notice any, were these letters just ink on paper for no reason?
No, they have impact. We were able to track savings because of, and changes of behavior because of it. And CMS uses these types of letters routinely, and they show savings every year because of it. So it is a good use of resources that can, you know, get you some savings or what is it, money not ill spent in terms of the ROI.
So wait, what do you, so, you know, in putting these letters together, you know, obviously you're going to have an instance where the provider is going to call you up and they may say, you know, oh, I didn't realize it, or you know, go pound sand or something like that. So, you know, the letters obviously have some value. What's your take on responsiveness of providers to these letters, kind of overall?
I think generally, I don't think they ignore them. I think it gets their attention, and that's kind of the purpose of it is to make them, you know, maybe lose some sleep over how they've been conducting business and get a change in, you know, a lot of times they'll contact us. I don't think I've seen any where it gets to the point of they're going to do like a self-disclosure and, you know, come clean. But I do think you definitely see a change in behavior. You can see a change in the billing. I think a lot of times they do call and they want to kind of cooperate and, you know, they have, you know, excuses like you say as to they didn't realize what they were doing or something like that. But I think if you look at the cost, the resources it takes to send out a letter, it's next to nothing. You have a form letter, someone, you know, tweaks it a little bit and sends it off. It costs, you know, maybe a few dollars and a half hour of an investigator's time or whatever. And if you want to look at ROI, sending out that letter can make massive changes in their future billing. So they're definitely worth the very little effort that it takes to send them out.
If you include a copy of the press release or other public information on actions that have been taken against providers doing the same thing, it might increase the impact as well.
And so, Matt, as we kind of wrap up, I want, like, the last word on this is, what are your thoughts on seeking, like just from data, right? Like, I know in the payer space, the payers are always trying to identify ways in which a claim can be denied or an overpayment can be articulated and assessed in the absence of a medical record review. And so this seems to me, now there are a few instances that I know of. You've got some strict liability cases. We've talked about those. You know, overutilization, you can only do 3 a year of this or 1 a year, anything over that. And we've talked about some other schemes a little bit topically, that, you know, from the data you can say, no, this doesn't seem right. And this may fall into that category. Like, if someone never had the diagnosis that's required under a policy to pay for a TCD, and then until the day they have the test, the question is that enough cannon fodder to deny those claims? Or, you know, do you throw a provider on prepay? Do you deny those claims and let them appeal? Like, you know, ultimately, I think there's a number of different actions you can take. Should the warning letter be first? Should denials, like, you know, what's the process?
I think plans would be reticent to send out letters asking for money back without some due diligence being done in terms of proving that the service was not rendered or was medically unnecessary. So perhaps in our instance, you know, talking to a member or two saying, yeah, they got the test, they don't know why they never got the results. That's indicia of medical, you know, not being medically necessary. And get two or three of those, you can set a criteria and then send a letter out saying, we've done a preliminary investigation. We believe all of these to be false and we're going to deny them. And let them then come back and try to support them. You know, it's let them fight it from the outside. I think that is a strategy, but I think you do have to do some minor investigative work to validate your data-driven findings.
And this may be one of those examples where we do a probe, but we really go outside of what the normal standard of 30 or whatever the number is, where you do a really, really very five records for those dates, five different patients, five different dates of service, and you just kind of take a look at it from that 30,000 foot perspective and go, aha, there is something here. And, you know, you ask for the medical records. You know, if you're doing this, by the way, you're not just asking for the medical records for the date of service when they have the TCD. You've got to look at the medical records for some period of time beforehand, at least I would say one or two E&M visits beforehand, because you want to see, like, wait a minute, if this person is coming to me every 6 months for a medical issue right now in ophthalmology, remember, routine vision exams are not covered under the Medicare program. So these people are coming in with what would be otherwise considered a diagnosis of a medical condition requiring medical intervention from an ophthalmologist, because you're not just there for an eye exam and a refraction. And so I would surmise that if you were going to be doing this, you are looking at trying to take a look at least a little bit historically. So you'd need at least a visit or two prior to that date of service, because now all of a sudden, how does this person have this diagnosis? 3 months ago, they were seen by the ophthalmologist, and that wasn't even a diagnosis. And even if it was not a diagnosis, is it a suspected diagnosis? Is there something in the medical record? Because otherwise, how is it this person suddenly comes in and boom, they have this problem without any other diagnostic testing to support it? So I think you have to think in terms of doing that. But I do think you're right, Matt, maybe a limited review to at least see, are we looking to identify if there is fire where there's smoke beyond just the data? This is a little bit of a gray area, because you are talking about a medically unnecessary service versus something that's a strict liability. It says you can only do this X number of times a month, and then you've got to move on.
Yeah, I remember the U.S. Attorney's Office, I think it was in Texas, sent out demand letters without any type of investigation, just based on the pattern of behavior in the district, and got huge backlash for that, because they did not take the necessary steps to validate their findings.
Yeah, I worked on a project here a few years ago that was similar. U.S. Attorney's Office sent a demand letter to a provider for an impossible day. And they were a hospitalist, and they were E&Ms. And what the U.S. Attorney's Office basically did was nothing more than math. They took a billing history, they identified days where the provider billed over 24 hours time-wise, and sent basically a pre-demand letter saying you owe us X number of dollars, and it was just off of data. They didn't do anything, and you know, they engaged us. We wound up getting involved with U.S. Attorney's Office, and you know, the problem was is that they were really just looking at it from a time perspective. Not, it was right after the guidelines changed for E&Ms, so it wasn't with respect to the medical decision making, which would have allowed the provider to actually get in the number of people based upon that. So there is a fine line you have to draw about when you're going to look at these cases from a data perspective versus a medical record review perspective. Everybody knows that when you start to incorporate the review of medical records, your investigations take way longer, because you have the human element involved in having to look at these. So interesting food for thought. I'm going to be curious to see ultimately where this all goes. The fact that, again, on this case, seven providers all appear to be connected in some way, shape, or form. And again, we've talked about this, I think, ad nauseum, about the importance for the provider community to not inherently rely upon billing, coding, guidance, documentation, or what have you from the manufacturer. Always remember, the manufacturer is in their fiduciary interest to get you to buy that piece of equipment. So they will tell you what you need to know from an ROI perspective, a documentation perspective. Codes we've seen as successful, like you just, the manufacturer does not have the provider's best interest. The manufacturer has the manufacturer's best interest. So always keep that in mind, that billing and coding and suggested guidance is as good as the piece of paper it's written on, until you've had someone in the know give you the proper sequence of events that should come about. Number one being that the patient shouldn't miraculously have this diagnosis on the day that they get the test. There should be a buildup to it. So interesting case. Again, not huge dollar amounts. It was a short period of time. Relatively speaking, 18 to 22, you got COVID in there. So that's probably a little bit of the time frame, but it is something interesting. And again, why press releases are important to look at. You do have to take them with a grain of salt, but at least the overall facts you take with a grain of salt, because you don't know the details, but you at least look at the scheme and let that drive some of your intelligence gathering. So good stuff as always, gents. Always good to see you. As always, thanks everybody for joining us. Come get our newsletter every Friday delivered to your inbox Our refreshed website has all that information. And again, always Spotify and YouTube channel for our weekly recorded version of this podcast, as well as our previously recorded LinkedIn Lives after we've aired them. So as always, you can join us there. And of course, by joining us on LinkedIn and subscribing and following Advise Health on our LinkedIn page, you can get all of this information to you as it happens. We send out our stuff very quickly on LinkedIn. So as always, good seeing you guys. And thanks everybody for tuning in. And we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Have a good one, everyone.
Thank you all.
Thank you.